Well, we're going to be spending the next couple of days with Zen Master Hakuin. Great Zen Master Hakuin. And I hope that some of his spirit rubs off on us this weekend. That you and I find a more abiding faith in Buddha nature, that we have Buddha nature. That's what Hakuin starts this song with. That we practice diligently, as he did, with a lot of passion and creativity. I hope that we're honest as he was during our journey, honest with ourselves, and finally that when we leave this weekend, that we will honestly work to incorporate this practice into our everyday life. When Zen Master Hakuin died, he was the most respected teacher in Japan. He died in 1768. He is well known for revitalizing the Rinzai Zen school, this school of which we're a part. When he was young, his mother was quite religious. She was a member of the Nichiren sect of Buddhism. And she was kind of a fundamentalist, it sounds like, to me. I mean, there were fundamentalists in those days. And, you know, maybe some of you can relate to growing up in a household where Hakuin's was, in his autobiography, goes on for some pages about this sermon that he heard, in which the teacher went on to describe in great detail the pains and sufferings and tribulations of the eight hot hells. So it's not only in the South that they talk about things like that. It's also in Japan as well in that day. And it really affected him. He really worried him. I thought I'd read a little bit here from his autobiography. He was going to take a bath, a hot bath. His mother made him a hot bath. And he lost it, crying. He couldn't go in. I can't see what's so frightening about gurgling water. Oh, just the sound of the bathtub, the growling sounds from the bathtub terrified him. Why are you afraid of gurgling water? Mother, you don't understand. I can't even go into the bath without having my knees knock and my blood run cold. Just think what it will be like when I have to face the burning fires of hell all by myself. What am I going to do? Isn't there any way to escape? Do I have to sit back and wait calmly until death comes? If you know something, please tell me about it. I want to know everything. You can just imagine this kid, you know? I think of that sometimes when, I mean, we don't talk about hell much in the Zen school. But if you grow up with an idea like that, or if that's your mythology, it can really be frightening. But at the same time, just that part about death, I think, whether you grow up in a fundamentalist back with a fundamentalist background or not, we all at some point realize that, have this awful realization that this story is going to end with our own death. That's something that we all have, whether we're fundamentalists or not. Whether we, the fires of hell might be something else, but to lose this life that is so precious to us, I think that's one of the things that pushed the Buddha out on his journey, propelled him, was to see that, oh my gosh, he asked his charioteer, is this going to happen to me too, this death? Yes, sire, it will. Oh my gosh, that's going to happen. So he, that drove him, his mother was very kind, you know, from his autobiography, just held him and said, we'll talk to the priest about it. And the priest gave him some sutra to chant. And then he moved to the Kuan Yin, to chanting to Kuan Yin. And that really helped him. But it wasn't enough. He had to, he decided that when he was 14, he had to join the life of practice. So it really haunted him. And it drove him into practice. When he was 24, so after he'd been practicing for 10 years, he had an awakening. And he heard the temple bell ringing, and he woke up in a way that he hadn't before. He thought it was the biggest awakening that had happened in a couple of hundred years. He was convinced that that was the case. He strutted around with his awakened self. And, you know, guess what? It didn't last. He couldn't. He tried. He was honest about it. He, rather than just, you know, parade himself around for the rest of his days, he realized he couldn't incorporate it into his life. So he was honest about that with himself. And he doubled down on practice. And practiced harder and harder, more and more seriously. Until he had a breakdown. He had a physical and mental breakdown. I mean, it's almost, look, you know, folks that look at this say it looks like a nervous breakdown. And for a good, and he had physical issues, and also he couldn't practice. And that this went on for, I don't know how long, don't remember. But he sought the advice of a Taoist hermit. So he went outside, he talked to some Zen people, of course, but that didn't, they didn't answer it for him. So he had to go to outside to a Taoist hermit, and there he, this hermit gave him some exercises that then brought him back, brought his vitality back, and allowed him to sit again. It was when he was 42 that he had his great awakening. And he had that, this Nichiren school is, their big thing is the Lotus Sutra. Soka Gakkai is a kind of a branch of that, if anybody knows Soka Gakkai. And they chant Namu Ho Renge Kyo, right? Over and over again. That's the first line of the Lotus Sutra. And, you know, when he became a Zen student, he thought, Hakuin thought the Lotus Sutra was crap. It was, you know, just a bunch of stories. And not very interesting. His great awakening when he was reading the Lotus Sutra. And so he'd come back to it. And he realized that Bodhi mind, that this mind that we're looking for, is helping others. That was his big realization, that Bodhi mind is helping others. He was active in his practice, and he was in his writings. He saves his his criticisms are leveled in different directions, but he's particularly hard on the do-nothing Zen school. I don't know what the do-nothing Zen school was in those days. I think that was just his name for Zen folks who just sit and don't really work to incorporate it into their lives, as Shinjo, or some of you know her, said, you know, there are monks who they used to call at the monastery petrified monks, just sitting there, turned to stone, and also petrified of mixing it up in the real world. So we don't want to become petrified monks or practitioners. Hakuin was poor. He was born poor, and he stayed close to his roots. Though he was asked to go and serve at the monastery, the big monastery, he refused and stayed out in the country. Teaching commoners, using all kinds of different techniques, from using things from Confucianism and Taoism, Japanese folk religion. And I can imagine him singing this song to common folk, this song of praise for Zazen. And I would like us to sing this song, though not right now. Erin Durrett, I think, is going to come tomorrow. I don't know. I heard she signed up. And, I've given her a copy of this, and she's going to put it to music. I want us to sing this song. I love this this song here. I just can't find much argument with it at all. And this is Hakuin's song. I hope you'll sing it this weekend. Learn to sing it with your body. Well, all beings by nature are Buddha. As ice by nature is water. There it is. All beings by nature are Buddha. That's the fundamental point in Zen. That we are all really Buddhas. That's the starting point for Zen practice. That faith that I mentioned, it's Zen asks you to start with a little bit of faith that you actually are Buddha. You possess this Buddha nature. It's a birthright. So when I first went to Shokenko to meet the Roshi, Joshu Roshi, you know, what's read at the very first meeting is, please start your practice. I thought it was kind of almost funny. Please start your practice with a faith that you have Buddha nature and that you share that nature with every bird, every tree, every flower. And if you were to meet God and the devil, they would also meet. They would also have Buddha nature, share Buddha nature with you. Now we're reading about the Buddha, right? I'm doing a lot of more reading than I ever have about the original Buddha's teaching, the old teaching. And the way I read it, he starts with suffering. Life is suffering, and then the prescription to the suffering. It's a good way to start, I think. Like, what there is suffering, and here's what we do about it. But the Zen school's different. We even slipped in this little story that wasn't there before, about when the Buddha woke up, he said, his first words were, not the Four Noble Truths, which everybody else says were his first words, but everything is already enlightened. They just don't see it. What does that say? everything, every sentient being is already a Buddha. And all you have to do is see it. We slip that story in before the Four Noble Truths. So that's where the Zen school starts, which is kind of a positive place to start, I think. You have, believe it, you have this place inside yourself that wants to be quiet, that feels good about being quiet. And all we have to do, we don't have to go do something, find something outside of ourselves or connect with a God that's outside of ourselves. All we have to do is uncover it. That's it. So we're already enlightened. All we have to do is discover it. And, you know, that's a big all. All we have to do. That's all we have to do. But that's a very long all. And that's what we do. That's why we put down our cell phones for a weekend. Because our cell phones don't allow us to understand fully that we are Buddha. They pull us into the world of liking and disliking. If we're going to understand this Buddha nature, this quiet nature that doesn't want anything, that feels deeply okay with whatever is going to happen. We're going to die. We might go to the 8 hot hells. Okay. It's the big okay. If we're going to really understand that, we have to unplug from the world. We have to unplug from our desires, from our wants, our likes and dislikes. But we do ask you to start with a kind of confidence that it's there. And we ask you to sit up and look like a Buddha when you sit. Like, it's there. That quiet place is there. All we have to do is take the time to uncover it. We are in that. There is a way in which we are perfect. Just like we are, just right now. And I think about Hakuin's mother, you know, embracing her child. No matter what happens to that child, Hakuin's mother is going to embrace him. No matter if he runs off the rails, no matter what prison he ends up in, Hakuin's mother is going to embrace him. And there is, in a way, it feels to me like an embrace, that the world embraces us. If we can get quiet enough, we can feel that embrace and know that it's okay. We're going to die. It's okay. We're going to make lots of mistakes. It's okay. That's the Buddha nature aspect. And, you know, I'm not shy about saying that it's a goal that we have to find that, to uncover that. I've had a few conversations recently with folks who feel, and I get it, that if you make this practice too goal oriented, like if you we gotta find quiet. If you make it too goal oriented, then we don't get there because we're too worried about reaching that goal. I think it's possible to be too tight about that, about the goal of quiet on a weekend like this. and beat ourselves up because we have too many things to we have too many things running through our minds. There has to be some loosening up in order to just accept that we have that going on. But at the same time, it's possible to be too loose as well, in my opinion. That we just let things run on and on and on and on without asking ourselves. And this is what I want to ask you, and I want to ask me for this weekend. Asking ourselves to, as best we can, work toward getting quiet. Work toward not just outer quiet, but inner quiet. Because it's in that that quiet space that we really realize more deeply this Buddha nature that we, that as the Zen school talks about. It's in that that we can really identify with that Buddha nature. So I see it as an adventure that we are on. We're going to an adventure toward quiet. We might not even get close to quiet this weekend. Just might be that it's going to be that kind of a weekend. But working carefully, diligently toward that goal, we learn a lot about ourselves, even if we don't get very quiet, even if we don't get to this perfectly quiet place. We have a lot. In order to find that place, we have to learn to embrace ourselves, embrace our life, be okay with loose ends, the many loose ends that we have not tied up before this retreat, just hanging there. You know, when I die, I imagine I'll have unanswered emails in my inbox. That's going to be the way it is. We have to let those things just be. That's a kind of embrace of the messiness of our lives. We meet all kinds of things in a retreat like this. Also, we open ourselves up to all kinds of things, to joyful things, and also to demons within ourselves. Part of the process of getting quiet, for me at any rate, is learning to embrace those demons. To be okay with them, to be okay with them existing within myself. And if I embrace them, take the time to do that on the way down to that deeper quiet, that lake of tranquility at the bottom of myself, then I'm sitting together with that demon, staring out onto that quiet lake. And he or she isn't tossing rocks into the lake because I blew past him. So there is we learn a lot about ourselves by doing this practice, by working toward quiet. All beings by nature are Buddha. Fundamental. As ice by nature is water. Hakuin chooses his metaphor carefully here. Ice is solid, and water is liquid. I am solid. Ice represents the I am self, the fixed self. I am Koshin. My parents are Bob and Barbara. I like pizza. I don't like coconut. That's the I that I identify with. That's ice. Hakuin says, you are also, you may not remember it because you don't remember getting frozen, but you are water. You and I are water. And here on a retreat like this, you have a chance to melt a little bit. Even if it's just to feel the perspiration on the ice. You and I can melt this solid, tense self. And become more like water. Become our, what in Buddhism called your original nature. Understand it, feel it. Water which isn't fixed, but which flows, which meets everything. You know, doesn't kind of sit frozen regarding things, but meets them. And goes under, over, or around. Can we identify with that aspect of ourselves? I've got one more little thing to read here, which is, some of you probably heard this, poem by Walt Whitman, about meeting things, about this... this fluid self. There was a child went forth every day, and the first object he looked upon, that object he became. And that object became part of him for a day or a certain part of the day or for many years or stretching cycles of years. The early lilacs became part of this child, the grass, the white and red morning glories, and the white and red clover, and the song of the Phoebe bird, and the third-month lambs, and the sow's pink, faint litter, and the mare's foal, and the cow's calf, and the noisy brood of the barnyard, or the mire of the pond side, and the fish suspending themselves so curiously below there, and the beautiful, curious liquid, and the water plants with their graceful flatheads, all became part of him. When we're fluid, we can understand, we can feel that these things that we meet are part of ourselves. When we meet the tree, when we meet the sound of a bird, when we meet the feeling of feet on a Khinhin path, when we're not thinking about anything, that is us. That's all that that we are. And a retreat like this is a chance to feel that. To start to identify with that aspect of ourselves that just becomes whatever it meets, rather than resisting whatever it meets. Oh, I'm not that, or I'm not that. Or I like this and I don't like that. Because, to mix up the metaphor a little bit, we actually are, according to Zen, both ice and water at the same time. We're both solid and liquid. It's just that the solid part takes over. And we don't feel the liquid part. So here, in a retreat like this, it's a time to let go of that solid and to feel our liquid, to feel our fluid nature. It's our thoughts that distance ourselves from things. When we're not thinking, then we're together with them. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, no Buddha. Apart from water, there is no ice. Apart from beings, there is no Buddha. This is the same formula as form is emptiness, emptiness is form. You know, the great foundational formula. Just to tease it apart. And I promise, I'm going to quit soon. I'm not going through this as slowly as all this. But there's so much good stuff at the beginning. Apart from water, there is no ice. So that is to say, apart from Buddha, there are no beings. Apart, if there are no beings without Buddha, that don't have a Buddha, that don't have Buddha. The way I was taught by Joshu Roshi. Every sentient being has this Buddha nature aspect. Every sentient being has this zero aspect. We also have our own personal selves. Humans kind of do the human thing. Crickets do the cricket thing. Banana slugs have their own banana slug way of being and culture and preferences. But banana slugs also have this zero aspect, this quiet, restful aspect that doesn't want to do anything or need to be anything. Banana slugs have an easier time doing that than we do because they don't think as much about things. But that zero self, that Buddha nature, is the same in all sentient beings, that restful part. So by discovering our own restful part, we connect in that way with all sentient beings. And then apart from beings, there is no Buddha, which is to say that there is no Buddha that's outside of a being. Buddha is just an aspect of a being. There is no big Buddha out there, or Buddha energy out there, or up there in the sky. Buddha is just an aspect of beings. So how sad that people ignore the near and search for truth afar, like someone in the midst of water crying out in thirst. Water is all around, but I'm thirsty. Like a child of a wealthy home wandering among the poor. You and I feel like we're poor. Feel like we have, I feel like I have so many things to do, so many responsibilities. So many things are wrong. And I need this and I need that. And I don't have enough money also. But this tradition tells us we're rich. Each of us. We're actually rich. If we can give up everything, there's irony there. If we can give up everything, then we realize we have everything. Everything we meet, we already have, just like the poem said, Walt Whitman. We're actually rich. Have confidence in your high seat. Sit like a king. You have everything. Have confidence and work diligently to fully realize your riches.